It's been almost 3,000 years, and Greek mythology has proved that it is not going anywhere. But it can be difficult to find entertaining and engaging retellings of these myths that aren't fictionalized. Lucky for you, I'm here. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the Greek mythology and ancient history podcast of your dreams. I dive into the convoluted and confusing ancient sources so you don't have to. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets,
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Lessons from the world's top professors, anytime, anyplace. World history examined and science explained. This is One Day University. Welcome. This is Half Hour History, Secrets of the Medieval World. I'm your host, Mike Coscarelli. Last episode, we explored life in the medieval city. This week, the rise of monarchies and the election of popes, and even a time of papal monarchs. All this power leads to a lot of fighting over who was the ultimate authority in Europe. I'll let Chris fill you in.
So our next two topics kind of fit together. And they fit together because what we have in this high medieval period of about 1050 to about 1300 is the creation, not out of nothing, the development is a better way of putting it, of monarchies. We've had monarchies in the past, obviously. Certainly the Roman emperors were monarchs. We've had monarchs called pharaohs in Egypt and monarchs called kings and other things in ancient Mesopotamian civilizations. But this creation of a monarchy, a whole culture around a king and a court, really gets going in the Middle Ages in a way that we haven't seen since the time of Charlemagne, and that was short-lived. An important precedent, but short-lived. And it's important to remember that monarchies are being built, let's use that word, built in both the papacy and in these things that we're going to call nations. They're not nations in any modern sense, but there's this thing called France coming together, something called England and Germany and Spain coming together in a form that we haven't seen earlier. The relationship between different powers is the key to the story because, one, what's the relationship between religious power and political or civil power in a context that wouldn't separate them when we come at them from a context where we would separate them? Two, which is the higher authority and where does that authority come from? And three, how does it really play out in real life? So one of the interesting things is that these relationships among so-called church and so-called state, phrases that wouldn't mean anything to medieval people, what is the context and where does that come from? It actually comes from feudalism, that rural structure that we saw, that hierarchy that we saw several topics ago. And so let's go back to a particular aspect of feudalism that's very important, that's very key to this story, and that's full of competition and conflict and controversy. And it's this thing called investiture. So let's go back to the feudal oath. If you remember, the feudal oath took place when a man knelt down and put his hands like this, and his superior put his hands around those praying hands, and the kneeling person pledged his oath of fealty, inferior, to his superior. Now, to an illiterate audience, looking at that, if I'm kneeling in front of you and my hands are like this and you put your hands around mine, it's pretty clear that you're the boss and I'm the worker. But remember that I, in turn, down the line, would have replicated that ritual. And now I would be the superior and I would have an inferior below me. Well, this thing is called investiture. This process by which I give authority to you, you hand authority down, you owe me certain actions, is called investiture. And the investiture controversy, with a capital I and a capital C, is something some of you may remember from medieval history courses. But I think it's more helpful to look at it in terms of investiture controversies, because the big one that, you know, we'll be looking at in a little while is this big battle between a pope named Gregory and a Holy Roman Emperor named Henry, and that's sometimes called the investiture controversy. And it really played out all across the map of medieval Europe. Now, what are the issues? So, that kind of highest level of the feudal structure, when a bishop or an abbot received his beneficium or his office or his benefice from a superior, he received two sets of symbols. One are the symbols representing his temporal authority, and that might be some form of a scepter or a crown, or earth itself, symbolizing his authority over the land. It was typically a bowl with some soil in it. And then he would receive symbols of his spiritual authority. Now, this might be more familiar to us if you've ever seen an image of a bishop, right? So there's a crozier, which is a shepherd's crook, a mitre, what a lot of people call the pointy hat, and then a ring, which is worn here on the ring finger on the right hand. And as part of this ritual, the superior, who was usually a lay lord, would say to the inferior, a bishop or an abbot, accipe ecclesiam, accept the church, sometimes translated as receive the church. Now, if I'm looking at that, it sure looks to me like the bishop or the abbot is below the local lay lord. And that might be true in his temporal relationship, his vassal relationship, but it certainly isn't true in terms of his religious relationship, because the bishop does not report to the local duke. If he's got a theological question, he's going to go to an archbishop or the pope himself. So you can see that there's some ambiguity built in here that's not going to help the church. And on the largest scale, the biggest question as to which is the higher authority, we have examples of emperors vetoing papal elections or certain papal actions, because the emperor is going to say, hey, I'm Constantine, I'm Charlemagne, I'm Charles Martel, I'm the defender of the faith. On the other hand, popes are going to sometimes veto the action or the election or the appointment of an emperor, because emperors kind of needed the support of people. They're kind of a first among equals. And so the pope might say, well, that person looks suited for the government job, but morally, no way. That person is certainly not suited in order to be an emperor, and I don't want him battling me for ultimate power. It takes us back to this notion that we saw with Justinian of sacred kingship and the iconography of political theology in this blurred context of civil and state claims. So certainly one of those kings or emperors would say, hey, I got lots of precedents. I have my own authority. Look at me. I'm in charge. I have an army. You don't. But I'm the heir of Constantine and Charlemagne and Justinian. And certainly we have examples of you, the church authority, giving me authority, giving my mandate by an anointing or a crowning. Remember, Pepin the Short had been crowned and anointed, Charlemagne, Christmas Day. So too, a series of popes by the name of Otto the First and Otto the Second, both crowned in Rome. In fact, there were even discussions at this time as to whether the anointing of a king was a sacrament. And after this period of time, nobody talks about it as a sacrament because the church did not want that. The particular problem, it really comes together around the 1040s. There's a really good emperor by the name of Henry III. And this emperor takes his responsibility as defender of the faith very seriously. And he comes from Germany down into Italy a couple of times. And the papacy is a mess in the 1040s. There are three or four people in the 1040s claiming to be the true pope, and they are in and out of office. One of them is in and out of office three times over the course of about 12 years. Nobody knows who's in charge. And along comes the emperor. And Henry III, by dint of being the heir of Constantine and Charlemagne, says, you know what? It's my job to clean up this mess because you obviously are not cleaning up this mess. And he begins to appoint, engineer the election of a series of reform-minded popes who happen to be of German extraction. Perhaps no surprise there. And the interesting thing is that even though he says, I'm fulfilling the role of defensor fidei, or defender of the faith, those reforming popes start to say, thanks a lot for putting me on the throne. Now leave and I'll tell you what to do. Henry probably thought that he was faced with a great deal of ingratitude, but those reform-minded popes probably thought, no, they're cleaning up the shop. And so we look upon this period of time as one of Gregorian revolution. Now, at this point, having listened to six topics, you might think, I never knew there were so many revolutions in this period. But there were. There were really big changes. And some people used to call this a Gregorian Reformation. But the papacy before 1050 and the papacy after 1050, they look entirely different. Same sources of authority, but the way they operate entirely differently. And they take this title Gregorian off of a particular pope named Gregory, you know, top 10 on everybody's list. And Gregory was pope 1073 to 1085, but he was involved in the resolution of all of these schisms, and he worked for those reform-minded popes before that. So he was there for about 20 years before he himself was elected. So we call the popes before Gregory and after Gregory for about 200 years Gregorian popes. They're part of this revolution. And these Gregorian popes had a couple of goals. One was a slogan called the Libertas Ecclesiae, the freedom of the church. And what that meant was the freedom of the church to name her own leaders. So it used to be that a bishop died or an abbot died and the local lord says, no, well, that church, that basilica, that monastery, is in my jurisdiction as a vassal of the king, and so it's my job, it's my responsibility, it's my right to name that person. Well, the Pope says, well, that's terrific. That person might be your secular vassal, but that person is certainly not below you in the spiritual hierarchy or the spiritual authority. No way. You're not going to name that person. So Libertas Ecclesiae, the freedom of the church to name her own. Because what was happening was that these dukes and counts were naming their brothers-in-law, who might have nothing to do with a religious vocation, their cronies. It's cronyism. That's what it is. So they were also against something called simony. Simony is the buying and selling of church offices. It refers back to a passage in Christian scripture or the New Testament where Simon Peter, is performing miracles in the name of Jesus, and Simon Magus, the word magus in the ancient world meant a magician, says to him, come on, there's got to be a trick here. I'll pay you to show me how you do this trick. So that became the buying and selling of church offices, became called simony. And they were also against something called concubinage. Now, a little controversy here. Sometimes people say, well, priests in the Catholic tradition could be married for 1,000 years, and that they've only been prohibited from marriage for 1,000 years. That actually is true. It was on the books as far back as 300 or 400 that priests should be celibate. But more often than not, they had what we would call a common law marriage, by which a person wasn't legally married or sacramentally married in any modern sense, but everybody knew who the priest's wife was. And he would hand down the parish church, just like the butcher, the baker, or the candlestick maker, to his son, whether or not the son had a religious vocation. So this obviously is a problem because, again, you're not you don't have the integrity of the sacraments. It gets caught up in these inheritance issues. And so how did these Gregorian popes fight back through Peter? The ideology of St. Peter and papal supremacy. So Catholics believe, Christians believe at this point, Catholics and Protestants are going to be split on the interpretations of this later on, about 500 years later, that Peter receives from Christ the mandate or the commission. You are Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church. And so all bishops of Rome, later called the popes, will say that they have a unique commission. All bishops receive their authority from God. All bishops are equal, but there's one bishop who's more equal than others. And so what these popes begin to do is they use this phrase, by apostolic succession, in their sermons, in their letters. And so as they're writing to emperors, they say, literally, as some popes had said in the 400s, a pope named Leo had said in the 400s, when you speak to me, you speak to Peter. When I make a decision, I don't make a decision. Peter makes a decision. And therefore, it's Jesus. Now, if you'd like to come after me, you'd have to come after Peter. And if you'd like to come after Peter, you'd like to come after Jesus. Perhaps you'd like to rethink your challenge to my authority. And so they begin to use this ideology of Peter. And they also realize that if you can't beat him, join him.
It seems like the medieval popes were throwing down the gauntlet to establish their authority. We'll find out how that worked after the break.
Who hasn't heard names like Achilles or Odysseus, Cassandra, Medusa? But how much do you know about them from the ancient world? Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the podcast bringing the ancient sources to life. Greek myth and history is timeless, and unless you've been living under a rock, you have seen just how true that is today. But there is so much more to these characters and stories than what pop culture can do justice. I'm Liv Albert, the host of Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, and every week I bring you stories from the ancient world, both mythological and historical, to breathe new life into these thousands of years old stories. I'm also regularly joined by some of the most brilliant names in the field of archaeology and ancient history, authors of your favorite retellings from today, and everyone in between. Join me as I dive into the wild world of the ancient Greeks and their stories. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
Western nations like the U.S. and Europe.
Mexico will likely have its first female president.
And then you have China.
And help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters.
He'll get his yo-yos to Europe in time. But the longer this drags on, the more worry he's getting.
They knew that they needed to do this as fast as they possibly could to get a drug on the market as fast as they could.
I'm David Gura.
I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen. We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets.
Basically, everyone was expecting, if not a calamity, certainly a recession.
But the problem is that paperwork, as our reporting showed, is fake.
As someone who's covering the market, I'm often very worried about an imminent collapse. So I'm thinking about it quite often.
Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is an NAACP and Webby Award-winning podcast dedicated to all things mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. Here, we have the conversations that help Black women decipher how their past inform who they are today, and use that information to decide who they want to be moving forward. We chat about things like how to establish routines that center self-care, what burnout looks and feels like, and defining what aspects of our lives are making us happy and what parts are holding us back. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.
So So since they're going against this imperial monarchy and a king in France and kings in Spain and a king in England, they need to set up a parallel monarchy. So just as there's a court or a curia among a king, they set up the College of Cardinals, which had kind of precedence earlier, but doesn't cohere. Remember, the papacy doesn't look after 1100 as it did before. This College of Cardinals, which gets a little bit bigger, but in the medieval world, a couple of dozen would be a large College of Cardinals. Now we have about 120. And the College of Cardinals become the ambassadors, become the legates, become the representatives, and they are the ones who exclusively elect the popes. Why? Because the freedom of the church to name her own needs an example. And the best example would be the election of a pope to show all the others this is how it's done. This is the freedom of the election. And so if I'm creating this administrative top-down structure, I need to set up what we would call departments, sometimes called congregations nowadays. And so these structures begin to get cohered. They had precedence in the past, but now more organized, such as a chancery, which is an office for the receiving, recording, copying, sending out of documents in a world before printers and copy machines. A financial department called the Camera. A camera is a room, and they would count the money in a sealed room. Court systems as well, and cardinals would be in charge of all of these and work their way up to pope, usually. So now let's look at, you know, the movie version of this, right? The case study, the big scene, and it's right out of Hollywood. Somebody really needs to make a movie out of this, between Gregory VII and the Holy Roman Emperor Henry IV. Henry IV is a very, very long reign. Henry IV likely knew Gregory VII before he was made pope. His name was Hildebrand, had some German blood, some Italian blood as well. Gregory VII involved in all of these reform-minded popes. And now the question is, who's in charge? This is a battle royal. The flashpoint is Milan. Now think of where Milan is, right? It's at the top of Italy. So it's kind of like a connection between the empire. Most of the territory of the empire is modern-day Germany and Italy. So that Archbishop of Milan is a pretty key person if you're the emperor looking to come down or the pope looking to extend your authority north. And so each appoints his own man, claiming that he, emperor or pope, has the ultimate authority. And that is the trigger. And what happens are like these series of acts in a play. It's Henry versus Gregory. But the big problem for Gregory is you have these bishops who are in Germany who owe their secular power and their wealth, and in some cases their jobs, their appointments, to the king, the emperor. We call these the prince bishops. The prince bishops are going to give Luther paroxysms of anger 500 years later. And these prince bishops line up with Henry, gulp, not with Gregory, their religious authority. So now Gregory is facing a revolt from his own men as well. And so Gregory says, you know what I'm going to do? And in his letters, he writes, by apostolic succession. At one point, he sends him, it was the formula to send someone an apostolic blessing, the blessing of Peter. And Gregory sends Henry a letter and he says, I send you an apostolic blessing, provided that you are an obedient son. Kind of like raising your hands and giving a blessing and then stopping and say, I won't do this unless you clean up your toys. And Gregory excommunicates and deposes Henry. Well, there is no greater exercise of your authority than to say, you're out, right? Someone can say to me, you know, you have no authority to teach. And I would say, well, by what authority do you say I have no authority to teach? You don't like my class? You didn't like your grade? You know, that's not how it works. Everybody has got a boss, right? So Gregory is saying, I'm your ultimate boss. I don't really care that you're Holy Roman Emperor. My boss is bigger than your boss. And so he excommunicates and deposes Henry, and then he turns the feudal system on its head. He says to all of the vassals who had taken an oath of fealty to Henry, who had knelt before Henry, he says, no deal. That oath is dissolved. You owe this man nothing. And if you follow this man, you will be excommunicated and deposed because you are following somebody who is out of the body of the church. And that's a bad scene. Now you have a lot of people who are going to say, oh, this is terrific. Henry has not been a great emperor to me. He gave me a job. That's terrific. But he taxes me. Let's get rid of Henry. Henry's in a tough situation. So in this dramatic scene known as the Snows of Canossa, this is the drama. Apparently, we're told that Henry stood barefoot as a penitent in the snow outside of a monastery at Canossa, begging Gregory VII for forgiveness for 3 days. Likely that meant 5 minutes over the course of 3 days as a symbolic action. And Gregory is persuaded, well, let me show some mercy here. And he forgives Henry. He puts him back on the throne and he brings him back into the body of the church. But the damage has really been done for a couple of years back home. And Henry can't fight Gregory for a while because he's got all these people who are now, you know, risen up against him in a civil war. So it's not until a few years later that Henry gathers himself again and attacks Rome. Gregory flees, and in fact, Gregory dies in exile a few years later. So it looks like Henry's won. Now let's step away from the drama. Cooler heads are going to prevail. People are going to say, listen, we have to coexist. This is a difficult question. We're not going to resolve the question. We need to do business with each other. Let's come to an arbitration. And about 40 years later, that arbitration produces a truce. It's called the Concordat of Worms in 1122. And a later pope, in this case by the name of Calixtus, and a later emperor, in this case an emperor by the name of Henry V, decide we're going to find a middle ground. And this is the middle ground. Henry V says, I'm going to renounce my rights to give you the spiritual symbols. Not my place. A religious representative will give you the crozier, the mitre, and the ring. And Calixtus says, fair enough. Therefore, I am going to renounce any right that I claimed or my predecessors claimed that I had, and I am going to concede that you have the right to invest with the temporal symbols, the scepter, the crown, the clod of earth. So now we've kind of separated these two, this one ritual into two separate rituals. So let's look at how that actually would have worked. So a bishop or an abbot, now typically appointed by the Pope or elected among his own monks or local priests, is going to kneel before a representative of the Pope, likely a cardinal, and receive mitre, crozier, and ring. Then he's going to move to another spot. Typically, this is done in a church, might be done in the same ceremony, might be done later on in a castle, and that bishop or abbot will kneel before a representative of the emperor, maybe Henry himself, and receive this temporal symbols, scepter, crown, bowl of soil or earth. But there's a catch. There's always a catch, right? The catch is, Henry has said, I agree to a free election. If there's a bishop who dies and the priests are going to elect him, or an abbot who dies, or an abbess who dies and the monks or nuns are going to elect him, I claim a right that my legate can be present. Now you can see here what's going on, right? You could see a situation where all of a bunch of priests are in a diocese are gathered together, they're talking, they're thinking, they're politicking, they're praying, and they say, we settle on Father Max. And Father Max is going to be Bishop Max. And the legate of the emperor does this. And everyone says, you know, maybe Father Max isn't such a good idea. And so they'll go to Father Michael, or the next person in line. So it's an uneasy truce. I mentioned earlier that it's a truce, but it is in fact an uneasy truce. But you know, half a loaf is better than none. That's at least how the popes see it. Now, this thing about election, let me just say very quickly, is nowadays, if a bishop dies in the Catholic tradition, nobody looks to the mayor or the governor to appoint the bishop. The Pope appoints the bishop. But in Protestant churches, sometimes there's an appointment and sometimes there's an election. Whether it's an appointment or an appointment from the top or an election from below, the church is still asserting this principle of freedom, the freedom of the church without inside interference, although as we've seen, the cleared throat clause, as it's sometimes called in the Concordat of Worms, gives the legate an opportunity to make his boss's name known. So what we really have through about 1300 are a series of papal monarchs, all Gregorian in terms of their goals, some more successful than others, some stronger than others, and some who really tried to be the ultimate authority in Europe, which in that time would be the world, and the most important one of those would be Innocent III. Someone once said that Innocent III, the canon lawyer pope, elected at 37 but dies at 51, what if he had lived another 30 or 40 years, that Innocent III was the last pope who could have claimed to have been the emperor of the world.
What a note to end on. Thanks for listening to another episode of Half Hour History, Secrets of the Medieval World. Next time, the beginnings of the modern nation state. We're a long way from the UN, but every idea has to start somewhere, right? Half Hour History, Secrets of the Medieval World from One Day University is a production of iHeart Podcasts and School of Humans. If you're enjoying the show, leave a review in your favorite podcast app and check out the Curiosity Audio Network for podcasts covering history, pop culture, true crime, and more.
School of Humans.
It's been almost 3,000 years, and Greek mythology has proved that it is not going anywhere. But it can be difficult to find entertaining and engaging retellings of these myths that aren't fictionalized. Lucky for you, I'm here. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the Greek mythology and ancient history podcast of your dreams. I dive into the convoluted and confusing ancient sources so you don't have to. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.